talks with
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are trying to siege, please.
So thank you very much. So what I'd like to do, this just a reminder to everybody, today is a special board meeting. We set this up as a two-dayer so that today is an opportunity for the board to hear about decisions that we'll be making tomorrow and to explore the information that staff and publics bring to us today. So the, you know, we're going to be focused on the things that are on the agenda, and we will not be making any decisions today. We'll be putting those for tomorrow. So with that, I'd like to ask Patricia to give us a safety briefing, and then we'll go into introductions.
Welcome to the Natural Resources Building. At this time, I ask you to silence any noise-making devices. Thank you, Mr. Shaw, for taking care of that already. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in the front of the room. Then the first door on your left, moving east towards the grassy area along Jefferson Street. There, DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to any emergencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. So I'd like to start off by acknowledging and recognizing we've got at least one legislator in the crowd, Representative Blake, if you want to wave. Thank you for coming. Would you like to lead off, Lisa, an introduction, please?
Hi, I'm Lisa Janicki. I'm Skagit County Commissioner representing the counties.
Tom Nelson, public member.
Patrick Happer, I'm the director's designee with the Washington State Department of Agriculture.
Brent Davis, public.
Carl Smith, R.L. Smith Logging.
Morning, everybody. Tom Laurie, Department of Ecology, designee.
Stephen Murnath, DNR and Commissioner's designee to chair the board.
Paula Swedeen, general public member. Heather Ballish, Department of Commerce, designee.
Bob Gunther, public member. I represent the small landowners.
Good morning. I'm Dave Herrera, I'm general public member.
Good morning, I'm Noel Willett. I'm the Timber Products Union Representative.
Morning, Joe Storer, Fish and Wildlife.
So, Patricia, can we, Patricia, other staff please introduce themselves.
Good morning, Joe Schrammick, DNR Forest Practices Division Manager.
Phil Ferrister, Senior Counsel, Council of Oregon.
Mark Engel, DNR Assistant Division Manager.
Thank you. Patricia, you got a list of public comment?
Yes.
So just a reminder, if the public would please keep their comments today to the items on the agenda. We'll have a general public comment session tomorrow in which the public can talk to us about anything that might be on their mind. Okay, so here's what I would suggest is we try and keep these to 3 or 4 minutes and so that we can keep going. But we know, I also want to recognize that I understand that these are topics that everybody's been waiting to make time for with the board. And so why don't we get going. Jim Peters from the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission.
Thank you.
Good morning. Jim Peters, Northwest Indian Fish Commission, and it's always an honor and a pleasure to be talking in front of all of you guys. I represent the Western Washington tribes and TFW policy arena, and you may or may not heard of a meeting that I had called last Wednesday, and it was only for the intent of trying to get one last chance to get a group of caucuses along with their technical people to try to come in and resolve some of the issues to make your guys' job a little bit easier in the next couple of days or the next couple of months on fish typing issues or stream typing issues. When I heard that there was a concern from the AGs that if we had a quorum that would violate the Open Meetings Act or something like that, I took heart to that. However, and maybe this is because I'm old school and didn't read the new rules and regulations on how TFW works anymore, but I assume that our policy process was completed because we did not come to an agreement on some of these issues, and that usually at that point in time, then policy's done, we'll have a majority-minority vote or a position coming forward, and that caucuses are basically on their own to come and either come and support things and stuff like that. So, but with hearing that concern, if we would have had a quorum, I was going to step out of the meeting to just try to make sure that we were able to have another discussion with our technical people to see to forward something forward. And you might hear some difference of opinions of that from other caucuses, but I wanted to make sure that you heard from me that the intent of this was still to try to get something in front of you that we had some consensus on that we weren't able to do through the mediation part of it. TFW is one of those things that if this is a hindrance of us being able to work with each other without being sanctioned by policy, the board, or DNR, then we should take that label off of this process, because that's what this is all about, is getting people together either inside those meetings or outside the meeting. And I am going to encourage our technical staff on the tribal side, at least Western Washington, to continue this type of relationship with the technical people of the other caucuses, so that by the time that we have some hard decisions coming up from policy, some of that stuff has already happened, and that could help us come to consensus at the policy level, which in return helps you guys make your decisions. One other quick thing is the AMPA is coming forward with some recommendations on efficiencies and things like that. I would hope either today or tomorrow you don't make a decision on that, because although we did get a verbal briefing at last week's policy meeting, yesterday was the first day that I saw it in writing, and I will need to have a chance to sit down with my caucus and walk through some of those type of things and hopefully give feedback to the AMPA on at least what our opinion is, that what we agree with and what we might need to tweak based on those recommendations there. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Adrian Miller, please.
Good morning. It's nice to be in the public. Got 3 points I want to cover today. First of all, really relating to sort of broadly adaptive management, but also the water typing issue. They'll kind of dovetail together. But I want to lead off with, you're going to hear a lot today and tomorrow about where TFW policy is in disagreement, and that's fair. However, I want to draw your attention to the significant number of recommendations where TFW policy was in agreement around the water typing process. So just not to lose sight of that in the overarching discussion on adaptive management and the water typing issue. Second, delving into those points of non-consensus, the first one I think is relatively easy for the board. That's off-channel habitat. You know, this in this particular case, the difference, I believe, is clearly articulated in the documentation. I think there's a clear majority opinion. I think there's wide agreement that off-channel habitat is indeed a type F water, and that the difference is really on how you establish the outer margin of that off-channel habitat. And from ORM's perspective, the proposal outlined in the majority of the opinion is enforceable, repeatable, measurable, and I think will lend to a great deal of improvement in protecting that resource. Now, the actual establishment of the FN break isn't as clear, and I think that the board is going to be faced with going through a pretty voluminous record of opinions and information. And I think that there will likely appear a number of possible pathways forward. Some of those likely will require some additional technical work. And what I would encourage the board to think about at this stage in the process, we've had at least two sort of runs through the policy process. And while we've considerably narrowed the scope of disagreement, I'm not entirely convinced that sending that back to policy for another technical review is appropriate. However, it is important that the board's decision be based on sound scientific information. So if the board finds that information is not in the record to support a decision, I think the board could run its own technical process at this stage and actually aggregate that information to support a direction or decision. And with that, I'll end my comment unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Jenny Knoth, Green Corps.
Good morning. I'm Jenny Knoth, and I'm here today to give a perspective from a fairly small industrial landowner, at best that I read it. Green Crow is a relatively small, family-owned timber company with 50,000 acres, mostly located in the coastal western Washington. We invest heavily in the study of forest ecology, plant physiology, tree improvement techniques, and habitat improvement. We are actively engaged in the adaptive management program, supporting highly qualified research foresters in these positions within CEMER. And we grant access to our lands for research projects in support of the adaptive management program. We'd like to commend the efforts of TFW Policy Committee to come to consensus on many of the topics regarding water typing. But our concern is that these efforts will be undermined through an artificial rush to produce a change in rule. There's been no evidence presented that the current rule requires change. We understand that this process is rough and it may seem to be without end. We're patient. We work with our regional forest practice foresters and our local stakeholders using the current protocols. We think the system is working well on the peninsula. The adaptive management process requires analysis of data and sound science before making changes in the rules. Setting the conditions of habitat likely to be used and determining the physical characteristics of fish habitat without data results in arbitrary regulatory points. Such arbitrary regulatory points is inconsistent with the goals of the 30-year-old timber fish and wildlife agreements and subsequent forest and fish report, which rely on stakeholder commitment to considering both biological and economic impact. You can imagine that in our 50,000 acres, the decisions you make here are very important to us, both on the biological and the economic side. We, like many landowners, embrace our role in sustainably growing and harvesting timber. Wood products are durable, renewable. There's a clear environmental, social, and economic benefit to this industry we're in. We make land management decisions based on science. It would be foolish not to. We trust you, the members of the board, to act in good faith and make decisions based on science. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jay. Norm Shaw. Alan Rick.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. I'm Norm Schaff. I'm the president of Maryland Ring in Port Angeles and manage timberlands primarily in western Washington. As with Jenny, for a small family-owned set of companies. One of the real benefits of working for a small company like that is that I can actually get out in the field once in a while. One of the really big benefits being president is that I can decide that I don't want to go out on a rainy day. So I have old rain gear that doesn't have to get used quite as much as some of my field people. But being out in the field reminds me of what it is like to implement and to work to implement the rules that this board passes. And a few years ago, I was a member of this board, so I know the difficulty that you face as board members in coming up with a rule that is going to meet all of the tests that are required. And I also know that sometimes there are unintended consequences of how rule language is put together. So I simply urge you to really reflect very carefully on how that is done. Listen to those that testify. How will a rule be implemented? And that's really one of the key objectives of the rules that are being considered now for water typing. They need to be implementable. They need to be repeatable. They need to be based on science. Those are all your guidelines, not mine. They need to be accurate. They need to balance the error and the risk. So those are things that hopefully you'll remember as you're going through this difficult process. I don't begin to think that it's anything simple, and you know, lots of people here in this room and others have worked for a long time to try to come up with solutions, and it's been tough. At the last Forest Practices Board meeting, I testified before you, and I'm not going to repeat all that, but I just want to remind you that we have found the map base to be fairly inaccurate for our particular timberlands. It may work in other areas. It doesn't work well for us. There's certainly a lack of consistency and any kind of statistical confidence in it. Where we have applied and actually found where last fish habitat is, not just last fish, but last fish habitat, it's all over the board, whether it's 2 feet or 20 feet, as far as streams width. 20%, 15%, 10%. There's very little consistency. So while a map base may be a recommended way to handle most situations, I don't think it handles all situations. So I hope you keep that in mind and retain that flexibility. Electrofishing is a tool that we use to help us find the right place on the ground. And we have a trained biologist, fisheries biologist, that does that work for us. I've been on site with him when he's done electrofishing. He does not kill fish. You know, you need to have enough of a stun to make them rise to the surface. One fish, that's all you need to do is see one fish, then you're done. You move upstream until you no longer find habitat. It's a pretty simple process, and it does not kill fish. Again, as you move forward with your rulemaking process, please bear in mind that ambiguity adds tremendous amount of costs and uncertainty and a lot of process without necessarily improving any kind of resource protection. I've seen some little bits of writing, and I don't really understand all what it is, but something about a 20% probability of fish passage, and I'm just wondering who in the heck is going to decide that on in the field. You know, is it the Forest Practices Forester? They're not fisheries biologists, even though they have good training. Do we want to add processes that we have to have a fish biologist out on every forest practice application? Somebody from DFW or one of the other agencies? I'm not sure that that's the intent of where we want to go with this. And that 20% fails to meet the other items that I mentioned earlier, balancing the risk based on science. Frankly, that doesn't pass the silly grin test. Having been on the ground, with some of these ambiguous rules that we do have to deal with already on field reviews, I can tell you that every time we have to bring an expert out, you know, I can write a check for $5,000. If he spends more than a day, it's 10. So there's a real impact to the viability of the forest products industry as a basis of having to call out an expert. And every time we've done it, we've essentially confirmed exactly what we laid out. We didn't change a ribbon on the ground, but we did have to add a lot of process. We did have to add a lot of expense. So I urge you to avoid things that add that ambiguity, that add to cost, without increasing resource protection where it is necessary. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Norm. Mary Skurlock, Conservation Caucus.
Morning, Chair Burnett, members of the board. My name is Mary Skurlock, and I am the TFW Policy Representative for the Forest and Fish Conservation Caucus. It's pretty exciting today. I haven't been this happy to be at a meeting in a while because it seems like we're at the end of a long tunnel, and I know that there's going to be another one after this, but it's going to be a different one. So it's an important day because you're doing the groundwork to take action on the framework for a permanent stream typing rule. It's been over 10 years since the board rejected the fish habitat model and the interim stream typing system was put in place. We've been working on this steadily since the day I walked in the door almost 5 years ago, since at least January of 2013 when we first invoked dispute resolution. And today I'm committing to you that at least I, and probably the other members of my caucus, won't complain about how long it took or what could have been done differently. Today we want to emphasize, as Adrian did earlier and others, that the process, zigging and zagging as it did, somehow worked to forge a broad base of agreement and shine a light on the disagreements. And there is more agreement than is apparent from the documents in some ways, so I hope that will come out later. We encourage you to dig in and ask questions about the disagreements, though, because they are important. Right now, I just want to emphasize what you heard also before, that this is a time for the board to begin to take the reins in truth and to recognize that policy's duties have been fulfilled. I think that there is likely going to be further technical work, but the board can and should oversee the remaining technical work. Despite the pile of paper in front of you, the essential problem, we believe, is not at all complicated. The board has a clear obligation to protect fish habitat that is defined as including unoccupied and restorable habitat. The interim stream typing system relies heavily, too heavily, on where fish can be detected today to determine fish habitat. This is supported by incontrovertible facts, including the conservation status of many covered fish populations, which has not changed and in many cases worsened, and that habitat is widely constrained and disconnected by artificial barriers. It is the current system, in our view, that is routinely setting arbitrary regulatory points, not the one that is proposed. There is too much reliance on electrofishing and best professional judgment around how to use that. The consensus framework is one of the documents that I'm not sure it rises to the top of the pile of paper that you have. It's attached to the mediator's report. I'm not sure where else it appears. It is based on potential habitat breaks, which use permanent natural barriers, certain to block upstream access, as well as features with some likelihood of passing fish, in combination with the parsimonious use of electrofishing surveys to determine when these breaks should be set as the FN break. Policy also recommended that the board provide the level of risk that they are willing to accept on the probability that a fish can pass above a potential habitat break, although there was not agreement on whether the board can make this decision now. I commend to you the fact that a majority of caucuses voted on May 4th, just last Thursday, on one of the items of disagreement in that consensus framework, to establish potential habitat break metrics based on an objective of providing passage of 20% or less, the 80-20 rule. And I want to also urge you to think about that number not as some arbitrary point that is somehow magically determined in the field by somebody. That is not the case. It's a policy objective that you would set in order to guide the work to develop the metrics. And the metrics, when they are put in place, would be, we believe, something exactly like stream gradient and stream width, which is now routinely used under the current system and we know is possible to implement on the ground. So the point is to take the subjectivity out of it. But in order to do that, we need to establish the objective for the policy. So that's the point, and you'll hear a lot more about that later. Consensus framework and the mediation package, commend that to you. The AMPA's majority-minority report, we saw this when you did. Like Jim Peters earlier, we've had some consternation around it. We'll be talking later after the presentation, possibly about issues we see with the way the information is presented on pages 2 and 3 of that document. And then lastly, we provided you with a stack of material that was strangely collated in one PDF and possibly wasn't clear that we have two documents with Conservation Caucus letterhead on them. One that goes to the fish habitat assessment method, the other goes to off-channel habitat. Those are the priorities for you all to look at if you're interested in our input on these matters today. So good luck, and thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, Mary. Karen Swager, WFPA.
Good morning, Chairman Neff and members of the Forest Practices Board. For the record, my name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the senior forester for the Washington Forest Protection Association. Thank you so much for the opportunity today to make comments. Our goal in terms of the water typing system is pretty simple: to develop a legally supportable, durable, scientifically sound water typing system that is in line with the forest and fish requirements for, and objectives for water typing, which are a high degree of accuracy and sharing of the remaining balance of error, and that it is enforceable, implementable, and reproducible. This process that we're going through in terms of adaptive management is a science-based process, and so science has to drive the process moving forward. As others have said, there has been a lot of progress made in terms of developing a new water typing system, and WFPA strongly supports the consensus recommendations that have come to you. And I'm just going to name a couple. I know that the staff will talk about these later, but looking at the fish habitat model and reviewing it, looking at physical defaults, including those physical defaults in eastern Washington, which to our knowledge are not based on any information or any data, and those in western Washington that are based on very limited data. The general water typing objectives have been agreed to by policy and accepted by the board, this question of the program being highly accurate and reducing systematic bias, the necessity for training programs, the development of a new board manual, and finally upgrades to the water type maps and a review of the documentation procedures to help the process move forward. We also support the use of the electrofishing working group report and the consensus elements of the, we call it the Hang the Flag group, a group of technical experts that talked about some of these issues related to drought and where and when you use fish windows to do the electrofishing. Those are excellent documents to begin the board manual discussions. We support the resolution to the dispute about water type modification points, that those points become the regulatory points until better information or new information is brought to bear. We also support the majority view regarding off-channel habitat, that the existing rule captures most, if not all, of the off-channel habitat, and we believe that the alternative that has been presented by the Conservation Caucus actually is a rule change requiring science. There are remaining issues, though, with the fish habitat assessment methodology, and that's probably where you'll spend the most of your time. WFPA does not believe that stream morphology should be used as a primary characteristic. It is a very important secondary characteristic that is something that we should look at in terms of board manual discussion and guidance, but there's not a parameter, a single parameter that you can measure that particular type of watershed with. And finally, just in terms of the fish habitat assessment methodology itself, the Forest and Fish Report, as I've said, envisioned that a highly accurate system would be adopted into rule, and it was the model that would achieve the objective of minimizing or reducing electrofishing. So once the board adopted the model maps, or the maps that came out of the model, that electrofishing would be reduced, and the physical parameters, those default parameters that are very conservative in the rule, would actually go away completely. So that was the envisionment of the Forest and Fish Report. The standards were stated in Forest and Fish Report and the HCP, and actually the BIOP for the HCP does the best and most elegant job of talking about this. It's on page 3 of my written comments that were submitted to you on Friday, but it says, failure to correctly identify fish-bearing waters will occur and is assumed to lessen over time. It is assumed that any methods used to map or delineate such waters will have an approximately equal probability of identifying waters as fish-bearing where fish do not actually occur, or the reverse, identifying waters as non-fish-bearing where fish actually do occur. It is further assumed that such errors will be relatively small and largely offset on the landscape scale. This assumption is based on the fact that this concept of equal error probabilities was inherent to the Forest Practices HCP. Again, we had consensus on this from Forest Policy and the board as recently as October and November of last year. Under the current rule, landowners can either identify fish use, which is spawning, rearing, migration, or use default physical parameters. The burden of conducting these surveys is placed entirely upon the landowners due to overly protective defaults. This was not envisioned at the Forest and Fish Point as a long-term expected obligation and was not included in the economic evaluations of the agreement. So today you're faced with looking at how we move forward in this process. What to do in terms of how the system is put together in the event that the modeled maps do not come to fruition. It's ironic that the reason that the board did not adopt the model maps in 2005 was because they didn't meet the accuracy requirements of the Forest and Fish Report, which was to be 95% accurate and sharing in bias. Selecting an arbitrary threshold, the threshold that Mary had talked about of 20%, below which no electrofishing or no look at fish presence would be allowed, is an arbitrary threshold at this point. There has been no evaluation of whether or not that is an appropriate threshold. We believe that going back to the Forest and Fish Report and looking at the objectives and the standards in that report are critical. And that standard was that the system would be highly accurate. Selecting an arbitrary threshold at this point for fish passage does not seem to us to allow the technical team the appropriate room to make decisions and have evaluations based on the full data that would be available. And so we think that it is premature at this point to select a particular percentage because it looks right or feels right or that's something that people think might be the right thing to do. So WFPA has suggested a draft motion, and it's just for your information on the back of our remarks that were submitted on Friday. And essentially what we would ask you to do is to put together a technical team based on the current experts that we have and others that may need to be added through the process if there's a gap in expertise. Give that group the charge of identifying parameters and metrics to look at specific items, specific factors for habitat delineation, and report back to the board. I think that process moving forward would give you a good scientific process that will pass muster in the technical world, the policy world, and the legal world. So I know that I've gone on a little bit long here, but I generally don't do this, but I have...
Please summarize.
I'm going to summarize. I'm actually going to summarize by, and I usually don't do this, but by relating a quote in a conversation I had with one of my colleagues, Ray Entz, who was the co-chair of TFW policy. And Ray and I at the last meeting were talking about these decisions and how the board and policy comes to decision making. And I thought his comment was brilliant. He said, we are engaged in fear-based decision making. Landowners fear that selecting a threshold will cut off a lot of potential stream miles that may not be fish habitat. And we, on the other side, who's speaking for his caucus, Eastern Washington Tribes, are concerned, and we have a fear that you're starting too low in the watershed and not appropriately using the tools in place. And I guess my response to him and my response to the board is that in the TFW adaptive management process, we aren't supposed to be using fear-based decision-making. We're supposed to be making decisions based on science. And what we would ask that you do is make sure that you have all the data and evaluation available and at your disposal before you make the decision on a particular threshold. So with that, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Kendra Smith.
Good morning, board members. Chairman Burnett. I'm Kendra Smith. I'm representing Washington State Association of Counties today. And I have the opportunity to follow such eloquent speakers that I'm not going to spend more of your time really reiterating what they have already said between Karen, Adrian, Norm. et cetera. But what I would like to offer is just so that you know from the county's perspective on this. Firstly, it was wonderful that the DNR stepped up with the framework that we started to work with, and then to also thank Jim Peters for knowing that there was an opportunity to try to move forward and what he tried to accomplish last week in the continuance of a technical group and moving forward. As I said, Washington State Association of Counties supports what you have heard so far from previous speakers, and most of what Mary said, where we do have consensus, maybe not everything there on that part, but it is very important that this be a highly accurate process. This is adaptive management. This needs to follow science. It has to be science-based. We can't be pulling things from the sky because we believe or we think we need to have science to back it up. And in order to do that, we follow all the other things that are required under Forest and Fish, the accurate, the balance, the repeatable, all the different things you've heard thus far. And so as you move forward with this work, and I know you have a lot in front of you, and then we're hoping that you will continue with this technical group and maybe adding some more stakeholders, so it's multi-stakeholders that are involved with this, and that we do move this in a science-based process instead of pulling things just because we're trying to grab a number to go forward on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kendra. Kevin Gabu, Weyerhaeuser.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Gabu of the Weyerhaeuser Company. Chairman Bernath, thank you for the opportunity and board members to speak to you. I'd also like to start with recognizing all the work that policy has done over the last year or so to complete a fair amount of tasks. And I think as we go forward and consider the remaining issues, let's not snap defeat from the jaws of victory over here. We've done a lot on the policy side, and I think people are pretty proud of the work. And so we've got to move forward with what we've got and continue to work on the tough issues before us. I will raise one kind of negative issue, which is, again, we have a big board meeting, a very important issue, and a lot of kind of recommendations, I guess, will come tomorrow. But you know, it's pretty hard from the public standpoint just to get information the day of or the day before to try to participate in it and make decisions. And so I made that comment when we were talking about the unstable slopes board manual. We're back again with a big, tough issue with not a whole lot of time. And I know that's the nature of the work we need to do, but it's the reality of trying to come with decisions. So keep that in mind as you have that conversation today. In terms of the water typing and fish habitat assessment method, which appears to be, you know, the major issue here, yeah, as stated, we do 400 to 600 of these assessments every year in terms of our company's operations, and we do need a field-based method which is highly accurate, repeatable, and equitably shares the risk. And we need tools like electrofishing and you know, well-known methods to go out and determine a starting point. And that some of the methods that are being talked about, you know, would artificially constrain our ability to actually do these surveys. And again, you know, 400 to 600, all of the stakeholders involved, and we're just, you know, one company, a very large one, but we need methods that work. We cannot, and it cannot be overly conservative. And I would just remind the board that I kind of showed up here in 1995, 1996, and that was the first emergency rule in 1996, was essentially the rules that we are continuing to work on. So we have had 20 years of a process, and that, you know, more or less, it's been state policy. It's arguably it's state law because it was baked into the Forest and Fish Agreement, which was adopted as law by the state legislature, which talked about, you know, the issues that Karen said about the fish habitat system that we would have would be highly accurate. It would have an equal probability, and in essence, we have been through this board passing multiple emergency rules. We've looked at this issue multiple times. It's very difficult. Hence, we've had a system that's worked for us for 20 years, and we are incrementally building that map that we have talked about. We're probably 60 or 70% statewide of having done, you know, 20 years of water typing assessments, and we have a map that is being built, And what we're talking about is the last increment here. The next 5 to 10 years, we will have a map completed using this method. So I would say that, you know, the burden is really on someone else to come in and tell the board we need to do something substantially different would seem to me to be quite a stretch. And at this point, policy seems to be stuck on this idea that we can somehow determine the probability of fish moving beyond some potential habitat break. And we're supposed to do that without any type of electrofishing or limits on electrofishing that make it almost impossible to potentially start that. Yeah, we kind of question just, yeah, is that even possible? Determining the probability of fish passage or moving beyond some point in a stream, where is the science? How does one come out and say it's a 1 in 5 chance, it's a 50-50 chance? So we think that that direction of trying to pick a probability based upon some kind of theoretical risk, which we don't really know, is a departure from the foundational approach that we've used in with this board in terms of actually going out, looking at distribution, collecting data, and we haven't done risk assessments. And there is no science risk assessment about this, so it's just an arbitrary number that somebody picked out. I would just go back to the agreement. We had an agreement about, you know, an equal probability and sharing risk. I think that's where the board has to start from if you're going to, you know, address this issue of metrics. And so I think at the end of the day, my ask is that as you get all this information, we have a lot of good technical people here. We have, you know, good processes, whether it's through the adaptive management process or board directed, but we do need to have a technical group that's directed by this board to evaluate whether it's even possible to come up with this probability problem, and then what are the kind of economic impacts and the environmental benefits you're going to get from it. Otherwise, it's just going to be an arbitrary number that somebody picks out, and that will not stand the test of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin. Okay. That's the end of the public comment period, and we're going to go to our first agenda item beyond that. Steve Renault and Phil Ferrister from the AG's office are going to come up and talk about rules versus guidance at a high level. As you know, they're going to provide a legal framework. We've had questions both from the public and from board members regarding this. I would suggest the board ask clarifying questions to the extent you can, but there needs to be acknowledgement that you may have to take some of your discussion offline with you on an individual basis. So, are you guys ready to go?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I'm Stephen Renault, Assistant Attorney General, and my sidekick here this morning is Phil Ferrister. Normally I'm the sidekick, the silent one on the side, but today we've reversed roles. So we're here today to talk about the distinction between a rule and guidance. Why is it important? Why is it important to know whether or not a rule meets the definition of, why a statement meets the definition of a rule under the APA, how the APA defines rule, and to describe a couple other statements that are non-rule statements. My objectives for you this morning are to leave this talk with an understanding of the consequence of not complying with rulemaking for statements that meet the definition of a rule under the APA. To understand the general types of agency statements that may meet that definition of a rule. And then hopefully also a couple circumstances of types of statements that meet the statutory definition. So why is this relevant to the Forest Practices Board? Well, it's relevant because you do have statutory authority. You're directed to adopt rules relating to forest practices, and you've also maintained a Forest Practices Board manual. That manual has been recognized in rule since 1976, and since 2012, the legislature actually first recognized the board manual, its contents, and directed some adoption of technical guidance regarding fish protection standards. So the board, therefore, is dealing with both guidance and rule writing. So why is it important to understand the distinction between, why not just adopt everything in guidance, even though you have authority in both? Well, there are four significant reasons. First of all, the legislature expressly requires statements that meet the definition of rule to be adopted following rulemaking procedures. That has certain characteristics you're familiar with: notice to the public, opportunity to participate. There's also evaluation of significant legislative rules for their economic impacts. In addition to that, the Forest Practices Board has the responsibility of following adaptive management for the adoption of rules relating, or water-related rules. The second reason, in addition to the legislature directing that certain procedures be followed for items meeting the definition of rule, is that properly adopted rules have the force and effect of law. The opposite of that is that a rule adopted without following proper process may be invalidated. And finally, the fourth reason that it's important is that administrative guidance does not have the force and effect of law. Agencies cannot enforce, therefore, administrative guidance. So let's cut to the chase. What is a rule? Well, Washington courts adopt and enforce or apply the definition provided under the APA. And the APA provides, has a long definition, which we'll get to in a second, but that definition could be summarized basically as a three-pronged statutory inquiry, which could be summed up as asking whether a statement has a legally binding effect by exposing a person to a penalty or affecting a person's legally created right. Now, because of its relationship to legally binding effect, it's also important to consider that using language that is more permissive is wise to do when not adopting a rule, but adopting guidance. So as to hopefully decrease the likelihood that guidance could be found to be a rule, and to make sure that the public is given the right indication of what the significance of that statement is. So,
yes,
please.
Okay, just for an example.
Certainly.
We're just talking like words may versus should.
Thank you very much for asking the question. Yes. So permissive language would be language like may, and even should is suggestive rather than shall or must.
Yeah, thank you.
Those would be mandatory. And so those would be more like language you'd expect to see in a rule. So let's look at the statutory definition of rule, since courts use that to determine whether or not something must go through the rulemaking process. Basically, and what you'll see is that I've taken out the three components of the definition that seem most applicable. There are five different subparts. Three appear to be relevant to our context. And so you'll see the letters reflecting that. A rule is an agency order, directive, or regulation of general applicability, A, the violation of which subjects a person to a penalty or administrative sanction, C, which establishes, alters, or revokes any qualification or requirement relating to the enjoyment of benefits or privileges conferred by law, or D, which establishes, alters, or revokes any qualifications or standards for the issuance, suspension, or revocation of licenses to pursue any commercial activity or profession. That's a lot to digest for me. And so I always need to try to simplify it, and that's what I try to do with the rest of this presentation, is to look specifically at the italicized phrases, because they may be terms of art in the context of the rule, to instead of use the term directs or directive as relating to orders, regulations, or directive, to use the term alters as relating to establishes, creates, alters, or revokes, just to simplify it. And then I've combined sections C and D because those two subparts are so similar in nature. They relate to amending qualifications or requirements or standards relating to a benefit or privilege. So the first key term in the statute to consider is general applicability. One might automatically think, well, a generally applicable statement would apply to everybody in the state. But the courts have specifically looked at that, and one case looked at the dioxin standard and found that no, it's adequate for a statement or a standard to relate to polluters. And obviously, not everybody in the state is polluting and causing the problem. So the court came up with a standard to say generally applicable for purposes of this rule means a directive is of general applicability when it applies to similarly situated people or entities. So a much smaller subsection.
So but, for example,
please,
Steve,
Stephen, yes.
So any rules we adopt apply to anybody who wants a forest practice permit.
Right, and that's one of the examples I come up with, and that's excellent. So it could relate to that. What this rule clarifies is that a directive does not need to apply to everyone in the state, or everyone who is regulated, but should apply to people of similar circumstance. And some examples of those things might be forest practices applicants, excellent. Applicants of similar class of forest practices, people conducting similar forest practices activities. Now, to put it in context of a directive that may be generally applicable in the forest practices context, just as an example, if DNR were to issue a memo and told its regional offices that all landowners whose property contains the state tree gets 50% off of forest practices application, well, that would be a generally applicable directive. It is applying to a subset, and that would require a rule. Now, what is the state tree? Does anybody know?
Hemlock.
Excellent. Way to go, way in the back. The western hemlock is the state tree per RCW 1.20.020. That might be one of the most important things to learn today. So we have, So that's generally applicable, it's important to consider. Now, what is the first then prong of the statute that we want to look at? We want to look at penalties or sanction. And what I try to do is just simplify the statutory language. And in the forest practices context, I think we could say that if a person may be penalized or sanctioned for violating a directive in the board manual directly, that directive must undergo rulemaking. And then to simplify that language a little further, because I like to have as few words as possible, I just created a little flow chart which says that where there's a directive, the violation of that directive leads to either a penalty or a sanction, those arrows going different ways, either or, then that would require a rule. The criterion looks at the regulatory consequence of non-compliance with an administrative directive. Basically, a penalty or a sanction relates to some sort of punishment, especially such as a financial consequence or other legal consequence. In the forest practices context, that may be a civil penalty or fine, or perhaps a notice to comply or a stop work order. Those would be penalties or administrative sanctions. The threat or actual imposition of a penalty or sanction is typically what we would consider to be an administrative enforcement of the regulatory scheme, making people do things that are contained in the rules. The directive that's involved with such a statement must be a rule if the agency is actually going to enforce it. For example, if DNR tried to enforce a guidance provision that all forest practices operators, this is timely, must wear a hard hat that has the Mariners logo on it, and if they don't, they'll be penalized. Well, that would meet the definition of a rule and could be challenged if it were not properly adopted through the rulemaking process. This rule influences DNR's enforcement of practices. When DNR enforces the Act and rules, it relies upon the language of the Act and rules themselves as the basis for a violation, not the language of the Forest Practices Board manual, for instance. The second consolidated element of the statutory rule is rules involving qualification for a person's benefits or privileges under the law or a permit. And a simplified statement here is simply a, if a guidance document alters a basis for obtaining or maintaining a benefit under the laws or rules, including a permit, that directive must undergo rulemaking. So, and here's our simplified little flow chart for those people who are a little bit more visual. What is a qualification or a requirement under this provision? A qualification or a requirement could be considered as a condition or an obligation to receiving or maintaining a right under the law. So in the forest practices context, forest practices applicants have the right to obtain a obtain a decision on a permit application after 30 days. The qualification that exists for that currently is that there be a complete and accurate application submitted for the department to make a decision on that application. Well, if there were to be imposed a new standard that applicant must complete a watershed analysis before even having their permit application reviewed, that would be a new standard, a new qualification, and that would be subject to a rule. A component of this, because we're talking, in discussing it, I've mentioned the right here, the right to have a decision on a forest practices application. That actually would be, instead of a permit or a license, it would be a benefit or privilege under the statute. So is a person's benefit or privilege under the statute being affected? The definition of a benefit or privilege would be as followed. A benefit or privilege conferred by law in the forest practices context would be a particular right or an advantage or an exemption from a duty or obligation provided by the Forest Practices Act. And this, in fact, in the case of Hillis v. Department of Ecology, dealt with water rights applications. In that case, the court found that merely the right to have an application for a water rights process, that itself was a benefit under the law, and that met the statutory element. So examples in the forest practices context, we already talked about one, but the right to harvest once a permit is obtained is certainly would be a legal right under the statute. Right to an application decision decided within 30 days, and perhaps CEPA exemption for class 1 through 3 forest practice applications. While there are many types of agency directives that meet the definition of a rule, there are also many, many more statements that do not meet the definition of a rule. I mean, we just see that from day to day. Agencies have many different types of written statements that don't meet the definition of rule, that don't go through the rulemaking process, and that's understood. Generally, the APA both recognizes and values, however, the benefit of having agencies share their insights with the public through their interpretations of laws and policies relating to the implementation of laws. So in this sense, the APA is looking at additional ways for agencies to give guidance to the public that are not necessarily in the form of a rule that would go through formal rulemaking. The APA has, in the 1988 APA, enacted 12 years after the board manual was first recognized in 76, recognized the value of agency guidance. And the two different types of guidance would be an interpretive statement, which provides an agency's written opinion about the meaning of a statute, rule, court decision, or an agency order, as well as a policy statement, providing an agency's written description of its current implementation approach regarding a law, rule, court decision, or court order. By sharing interpretive statements and policies, the public becomes better informed about what agencies believe might be necessary to ultimately comply with law. The APA continues to encourage agencies to adopt advisory guidance separate from the adoption of rules. The APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, encourages agencies to express their opinions, approaches, and likely courses of action through interpretive or policy statements. These, according to the Administrative Procedures Act, are advisory only. Therefore, they would not have binding legal effect. and thus interpretive or policy statements cannot be used to substitute for rules when an agency intends to dictate conduct or outcomes. The rule that only rules dictate conduct or outcomes is the same for all guidance documents published by an agency, regardless of their names. That means that whether it's adopted in the form of a board manual, the form of a letter, the form of anything else, that rule applies. Thus, the Forest Practices Board Manual cannot be used to dictate conduct or outcomes. Only the board's rules may have legal effects that dictate conduct or outcomes. To summarize, provide again a simplified version of what a rule is, I would simply describe them as a directive that, if violated, may result in a penalty or sanction to similarly situated people. A generally applicable directive altering a qualification or requirement affecting a law-based benefit, such as the right to a decision on an application within 30 days. Or a generally applicable directive altering a qualification or standard affecting a commercial license, or in this case, a forest practices permit, which meets the definition of a license. So what's the point? Does anyone know where we keep the unwritten rules? Well, rules have legally binding effect. They impact people's rights, and because of that, the legislature has determined that there are additional procedural rights that apply to statements that meet the definition of rule. Those rights include the notice and opportunity for the public to participate at a much higher level than other types of statements. A process that you're familiar with is represented by the requirement of adopting CR 101, CR 102, and CR 103 in going through the rulemaking process. Administrative guidance, however, may still be helpful and is in fact encouraged by the legislature to be used. But guidance does not have an independent legal effect. If guidance masquerades as a legal requirement, that's kind of the equivalent of an unwritten rule. Neither the board nor the department wants that. This is why it's important to limit the nature of the material that appears in documents such as the board manual. Thank you.
Questions from the board members?
Can you go back one slide?
Sure.
Or simplified?
Yes.
So, on the first one, would it be fair to all to say that a directive violated may result in a penalty, sanction, or benefit?
The statute specifically refers to a penalty.
To the negative side.
That's correct.
But yeah, I thought you were saying that also conferring.
It would be, and that would relate more to the second element. It would be whether or not something relates to a benefit or privilege that's granted underneath the statute. So if a statute or a rule that's established says that you have the right to a decision on a forest practices permit within 30 days, that would be a benefit or privilege under the statute. And so if there's a qualification that's affecting that right that exists in the statute, then it would be.
I'm just wondering if we affected it in a positive way from the standpoint of that.
Right.
So it'd be a clap, it'd be a something.
So one of the examples was, what if a department memo enabled people with Western Hemlock,
yes,
on their property,
yeah,
to receive 50% off,
yeah,
of the forest practices permit price?
Yeah.
That would be a benefit conferred to a class of people and would require rulemaking.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you have?
So, kind of bringing this to some of the issues that we have to grapple with in terms of board manuals that implement very technical things, and can tell me if I'm getting into something that we're not supposed to talk about. But I'm trying to be general here and just make sure I understand. So, a board manual. Board manual language is appropriate for situations where there is heterogeneity in the landscape or flexibility, or you don't have the same situation all the time, and you're describing to someone how you implement
how you implement a rule that has an intended outcome, but you might have different situations on the ground on how you implement that, and you need technical guidance. But it seems to me that we do run into some issues simply because this realm that we operate in can be highly technical. So I'm just trying to make sure that I understand the distinction that you are making is that it's a rule if someone has to do it the same way all the time, and it's guidance if there's flexibility on how you get to the outcome. Is that fair?
Not exactly.
Okay.
So, however, in the landscape, if you want to mandate or dictate people to do things in a certain way, however those situations appear, that needs to be in a rule. You cannot dictate outcomes in guidance.
Right.
That's the distinction.
Yes. So, yes, and that's what I was trying to say. But you might have different ways to get to the same outcome, and isn't the guidance...
Those ways should be in rule if you want to require people to do them in those ways. If it doesn't matter how people do them, then maybe guidance might be sufficient. Guidance should explain and illustrate that which is in the rule.
I'm wondering if, thinking about how we do roads, and one of the things about our roads rules is the policy statement up front in the roads section of the rules states some clear objectives, like disconnecting roads from streams and so forth. And then we have a really thick board manual on the many different EMPs that might be applied in order to achieve that objective. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I was trying to get at. Ways to get to the same outcome.
Yeah.
There are different potential ways to get to the same outcome.
Any other questions?
There were several comments earlier in the day around rules being ambiguous, and what's the role of guidance when the board perceives?
That's not something that we're going to discuss here today.
Okay, thank you. Here's the board chair.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, we're going to head into the water typing realm. And so the first thing we're going to do is, I think everybody, Mark and Nora Hans, we've got a table to show the board, or we have provided that table to the board. And we're going to go through all the, so if you recall what we did at the last board meeting, we provided a table to the board of all the actions the board has taken over time on unstable slopes. We want to do that same thing today as a starting point for water typing and bring you up to date to where we are now. So, Hans, if you could. And Ray, could you introduce yourselves, please?
Good morning, Chair Renath, members of the Forest Practices Board. My name is Hans Burge. I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator.
Good morning, Chair Renath and board members. Ray Entz with Kalispell Tribe of Indians, representing the Site Tribal Governments and co-chair of TFW Policy.
Okay, as Chair Renath mentioned, you in your packet from May 5th, 2017, there's a memorandum from Mark Engel. The subject is Forest Practice Board Actions Regarding Permanent Water Typing System Rule and Associated TFW Policy Committee Work Product.
And on the,
pardon?
Today's packet.
It's in today's packet.
In the binder clip or not binder? Oh, there we go.
And on the third page, there's a table that looks like this.
It's labeled page one.
Oh, it's labeled page one. Okay, so I guess it's the page one of the attachment.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, are we ready?
Dave is still looking. It's a separate document in today's handout.
It's down past the really funny stuff.
So the Forest Practices Board actions regarding permanent water typing system rule, on the far left column, the presentation or request to the board is highlighted as the topic. Then it gets to board decision, motion, action, direction, status, and an actual date of completion. And so you'll see that it starts way back in February 2004 board meeting, and the February 2004 motion: the board directed staff and stakeholders to continue to move forward to fully implement the water typing model, accepting the map by March 1st, 2005, as presented today in the work plan. Okay, so that's where we start. Then I'm just going to go through this pretty quickly. Then if you get to the middle of the page, you'll see a box that goes across the entire page. It says, no board direction or action on a permanent water typing rule, February 2007 to November 2011. Then we get to November 2011, and in the far left box, there's an important topic there. Is policy had agreed that one of their top priorities for 2012 would be to develop recommendations to resolve type F water typing issues and the permanent water typing rule. So that was November 2011. And in the motion, the board directed policy to make the completion of the Clean Water Act assurances milestone the top priority, with water typing as the second. Okay, then we get down to the bottom of that page, the February 2014 board meeting. The AMPA, it's also on the same page, provided information on the water typing system dispute resolution, the issues under the dispute, and the timeline to complete them. And so that was when the board made the motion directing policy to take specific action on a number of pieces, which include the footprint of the interim rule for the pilot, the comparison of the water type designations to on-the-ground FPAs and water type mods, investigate additional model utility, provide information that can inform the board's basic as map as rule guidance with field adjustments. That was the first part about the model. And then the rest of the assignments that later became the matrix were directed back to policy. So then we jump to the August 2015 board meeting. At the bottom of the page three there on the left, policy co-chairs presented the type F matrix, which will be used to track policy's process as they relate to the board motions in type F. The board asked policy to update you at all of their meetings on where we were with water typing, and the matrix was accepted as the path forward for policy to bring recommendations to the board resolving water typing issues. And if you recall, the elements in the matrix were specifically looking at physical defaults, the model, off-channel habitat, and water type modifications, and default physicals were all a part of that. Okay. Then we get to page four. There was a a August 2016 board meeting, and DNR staff provided an overview of motions capturing elements of the matrix that had been completed and provided completion dates for the completion of policy work in the future. Then the board determined the draft motion would constrain the members of TFW policy, and the board established for policy an expectation of a permanent water typing system recommendation to be presented at the November 2016 board meeting. And then policy continued to try to resolve issues in the matrix. Okay, so then we got to the very important November 2016 board meeting. And the policy co-chairs presented an overview on the progress, consensus, and non-consensus pieces. And then the board made some very deliberate motions about for policy to complete the three outstanding issues where there was disagreement. And so policies, as a consequence of the motions in the 2016 November meeting, the CR 101 was filed in December 2016. Board staff began evaluating the conceptual rule process based on policy's recommendations, where there was, I would say, wild agreement, mostly. Policy invoked dispute resolution regarding the FHAM in 2016, off-channel habitat, and also the water type modifications, or what to do with the mapping as rule with water type modifications that had been processed and approved up until that point. And so then on top of that, the AMPA, myself, convened a technical group to develop study designs on default physical criteria and the model, on what to do with the model, and working with UW Precision Forestry to improve the things that they talked about. And so that's essentially where we are today. With the, on page six, we'll talk about the February 2017 board meeting. DNR staff presented the interim guidance that the outlines expectations for water type surveys was completed. So there was that first dispute resolution piece was agreed to and moved off the table. Two outstanding issues are still off-channel habitat and the FHAM. And so in February, just before the board meeting, stage two of dispute resolution at policy was invoked, and that required mediation. And so policy since, I guess March was when the first meetings were held, but since February has been in dispute resolution to talk about the two remaining areas of off-channel habitat and the fish habitat assessment method. And so to date, that's where we are. The stage two dispute resolution was completed a little over a week ago formally, and the majority and minority reports have been brought to the board as sort of a description of what took place during that mediation and where policy ended up in terms of the different votes on those two areas of disagreement. And so I'm going to walk you through this report that says water typing system policy recommendations summary for the Forest Practices Board.
And we will find that where?
Today's packet. This one? Yes. So I would like to say that the policy meeting that was held last Thursday, the topic was focused on putting a sharper focus on the areas of disagreement. And after or during the meeting, which was a long meeting, it took a long time to talk about issues that were in agreement versus disagreement, and still trying to find a solution. I just want you to all know that there was still some good faith discussions that were happening literally last Thursday to try to bring a clearer message to the Forest Practices Board today. So I just commend policy that they really were working up until the last minute, as Jim Peters said, even outside of the formal process, just trying to see if there was still any kind of a path. So that was the conclusion there. And so the first, just in terms of the report, the first paragraph really talks about the matrix and the pieces that we've already gone over. Then the second thing focuses on the FHAM with water type mods that that's done, but then we still have this FHAM in how to distinguish between the regulatory breaks of type F and type N waters, which you've heard a little bit about today. Then we went into stage one dispute resolution and stage two dispute resolution. And then in consensus, this is the real important piece, is to talk about the areas where there's consensus, which is most of it, actually. So the existing water type system rule language to carry forward into the new rule includes type S and N waters and many different pieces of type F water language. So those are done. The resolution of dispute over the water type modification points. The proposed framework, there was progress made on a framework where different caucuses worked with their technical experts to develop some fish habitat assessment methods. They were reviewed by an outside party to try to identify strengths and weaknesses and so forth in an objective way. And after doing that evaluation, it was very obvious that the framework of those methods were the same. Essentially, you start with a point where there's known fish, looking upstream, you identify some feature, we'll just call it a PHB, whatever that is, and then you start looking for fish above there using a protocol, and if you find a fish, you stop, you walk until you meet the next one, and then repeat the process on and on until you don't find any fish, then you turn around, walk back to that point, whatever it was, the PHB, and that is the proposed break for type F and type N waters. Makes sense, from a technical perspective, it makes sense from a practicalist perspective. The devil's in the detail of what constitutes the PHB. And that's exactly where policy has come down in this area of disagreement. And so then we get to, for type F, channelized streams. The RMZ starts at the outer edge.
Excuse me, yes. Hans, do we have that diagram so that people can...
Rock channel habitat?
No, for the... Well, what you just talked about the FHAM, and did the board members get the diagram that...
No, they did not. We can put that up after lunch if you'd like.
Okay, thank you.
Apologize for that.
And then same thing with the off-channel habitat.
We have the off-channel habitat on the computer here, and I can pull that up.
Excellent.
So the FHAM, the PHB, we're going to come back to that. We'll come back to that. So then we get into the off-channel habitat, which is the number four there. For channelized streams, those that have defined bedding banks, the RMZ starts at the outer edge of off-channel habitat, defined at the waters that are connected at the bankfull elevation and its edge as defined in WAC 222-16010, coincides there. And then for type F non-channelized streams, the edge of the off-channel habitat is the ordinary high water line. And that includes the portions of wetlands periodically inundated at the ordinary high water line. So the point there is, irrespective of the type of habitat that occurs in a non-channelized type F water, the ordinary high water line is the more appropriate datum to look for when you're setting the RMZ. That's fundamentally how that works. Somewhat equivalent or nearly equivalent to bankfull in terms of the datum, but there's a different method used to determine where it is. And we're gonna probably hear more about that. Okay, then we get into the areas on off-channel habitat. And as you can imagine, whenever you put anything on paper, trying to write someone else's perspective, there's a lot of disagreement with that person in which you're trying to capture their perspective. And so I just want to say this represents what the way I have interpreted it, the way that it's been presented to me at policy. Since this time and since reviewing this report, I understand that there are some nuances there that by the disagreeing parties feel are pretty important. But I'm just going to walk through the pieces that I focused on for the purposes of giving you a summary. The focus of the disagreement, it includes the it really comes down to how wetlands are incorporated into the definition of or the protection for off-channel habitat in the non-channelized portion of the stream if there's a wetland that co-occurs there. And the way that it was framed at policy was really the ordinary high water line, and then there was the edge or the full extent of the wetland. And the interpretation, the differences there were, one interpretation was, well, that's always the end of the wetland, right? The edge of the wetland, because you're looking for soil, changes in soil that are marked with water, periodically inundated, and then also the vegetation. And I think that's true in many, many cases, but there are also cases where saturated soil will also have the same type of vegetation as areas of a wetland that are periodically inundated, which wouldn't constitute fish habitat. And so that's where you get into some of the nuances. And so if what we've talked about during the course of this discussion was periodically inundated areas that are inundated regularly, you know, at an ordinary high water line are obviously going to be covered underneath type F waters as fish habitat. Fish can go there, it's type F water, right? So that part's really simple. And then the portion of the wetland that is not, doesn't have that regularly inundated mark on the soil, but still may contain the vegetation, for example, wouldn't fall into the fish habitat category. And so it really depends on the type of wetland soil that we're talking about. There's hydric soils that are not periodically inundated. They're saturated. Essentially, the water percolates down into the soil and it has a wetland character, but on the surface doesn't show that periodic inundation. And so I know we're getting a little bit into the weeds, but that is really the focus of where the disagreement is.
So can you put that diagram up so that the board members can visualize what you're talking about?
Doing that, I just think about this. It'd be nice to hear what wetland protections are there, regardless of the fish habitat signs, because they are protected to some extent.
Right. So there are three different classifications of wetlands. What happened?
It's a very steep slope.
So here's a drawing showing a typical channelized. It's a cross section in the plan view of Woods Mountain. Okay. And that just shows that the area on the right where the blue is the area that has water at the time of the survey. Okay. And then you use indicators to define what the level of the bank full is. You take the bank full laterally into the floodplain, essentially. It's a minor floodplain, I guess, in that case, small one. And then you get where there's not a CMZ. And that area that is below that dashed line of bank full is considered off-channel habitat. Doesn't have water in it at the time of survey. But it gets inundated with water on a regular interval, bank full 1.5 to 2 year interval, and it may have wetland vegetation, but the area above that, which could include here, there could be a wetland above that level, but isn't inundated, would be outside. Now, if the wetland boundary included the off-channel habitat, then the portion of the wetland that is below the bank full elevation in this case would be considered off-channel habitat. So that portion of the wetland would be off-channel habitat. Now the portion of the wetland to the right, where this arrow is right here, okay? So if the wetland boundary, if the wetland went from there to, let's say, here, but this was the portion at bank full this way, that would all be off-channel habitat. This portion of the wetland over here would apply, the wetland rules would apply. So for type A, type B, or forested wetland. In forested wetland, That's primarily where leave trees are placed. And then for type B and type A wetlands, there are separate buffers. And the way that this is applied on the ground, you would apply a type F buffer, which would be larger. But if there was a wetland that was within the RMZ of a type F water, the boundary would extend in the shape of the wetland beyond the boundary for the type F. If it's fully contained within a type F RMZ, then there would be no change on the outward edge of the RMZ. So what happens on the ground, the way this is applied, is whichever is greater. The one that requires the larger number of trees to be left, that's the one that applies on the ground. That's how this is done operationally. And so down below, this view just shows that how that could be connected. It's hard to see these colors, but this essentially is that area that's wet currently. And then the off-channel habitat at Bankful, the red line would go all the way out here. And so you could have vegetation in the middle of off-channel habitat that only has water every 1.5 to 2 years if it was, you know, really at the high level. At the lower level, it may be inundated more frequently than that, but it would still be off-channel habitat of that type F. So the idea is that it's conservative in the way that it doesn't look where there's water at the time of the survey to delineate what the off-channel habitat is. It uses a geomorphic characteristic to describe the full area where the channel is active, which would include off-channel habitat, where fish could go.
So let's stop there, and because this is one of the points of difference. And so let's have board members have the opportunity to ask questions.
This one, there's consensus. This one has consensus.
Okay. Channel ISIS.
These are channel ISIS.
This is channel ISIS.
Oh, good.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
We're good.
That was the easy one. Okay.
But let's change it anyway.
Yeah. How do we?
Can you do it?
You can do it, please. You to it, please.
Yeah,
IT.
Now we all get to look sideways.
I don't know where you're going to find it. I've been trying to do that.
Maybe you see this the other way.
There's off to the left.
The left corner. Nope.
I think that's an undo thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
You can't do it.
That was what I thought of too.
Can we just? Yeah, no. Trying to solve problems. We can see it.
I'll turn this. Yes.
This is a low tech solution. Only partially effective.
Okay.
There's your van.
You can stand there and hold it.
Okay. So this is gonna work. Okay.
Maybe.
You gotta stay there.
So here we have one side of a non-channelized type F water. The other side of this could be steep. There could be trees at the, you know, right at the bank or at the edge, the wetted edge. Doesn't really matter. So there's two scenarios that I want to talk about here. The first one I'm going to talk about is the top one. Again, this is non-channelized type F.